I've been doing mostly heads, portraits for the last 4 or 5 years and trying to do political work. I use collage material from the person's world. So I did a Trump using the Mueller report, and I would use the newspaper for someone involved in the financial crisis, say. I'd use the Wall Street Journal, and for Liz Cheney, I used her concession speech and a variety of other newspaper photos and text of the January 6th committee and her basically losing and being out of the House of Representatives.
Welcome to Warfare of Art and Law, the podcast that focuses on how justice does or doesn't play out when art and law overlap. Hi, everyone. It's Stephanie, and that was artist and attorney Jeff Stein from a recent Second Saturday Art and Justice online gathering. In the following conversation, he and a few of the other artists included in an upcoming New York City group show entitled Portraits as Still Lives discuss the work that they may be including in that show. In addition to confronting the viewer with visual representations of a head as an object, this show is also unique in that each of the artists included is also either studying or working in the law. There will be links in the show notes for each of the works referenced in the discussion. And there is an open call for this show for others with a similar background who would like to join. We first hear from artist and attorney Stefania Salas-Bruins about what prompted her to create the theme Portraits as Still Lives.
So when I started my MFA, I was actually mostly painting models and people that were posing. And I was not very much engaged with self-portraits at all. And I noticed that a lot of artists paint a lot of self-portraits. And I was wondering why that is. And a lot of times when you ask them, they say, oh, it's easy because I'm always there. I'm like, easy. I don't have to pay, you know. I'm a cheap and easy model. And I'm like thinking, well, I don't think I'm a great model because it's awful to have to stare at yourself. And, you know, I just didn't buy into that. But then slowly, as I was working through different pieces, I realized that certain things that you might want to do, you can't really accomplish with a different model than yourself. Like if you're going to behead someone in a painting, you really don't want to be doing that to someone else, because I feel like even if they are okay with it, they might change their mind. I don't know. So once I decided I was going to do a decapitated head, I was like, I really have to look at myself for this. And that sort of started this whole observation of a head as an object. And Stephanie, I was talking to you about it and sort of, I don't know, brainstorming. And I was thinking, well, maybe this is a feeling that others share, and sort of the observation of a head as an object. And if you look at art history, that's happened many times. Like, heads have been objects, and, you know, decapitation was a real thing. And so that's where that came from.
Yeah. Yeah. We had actually, right when we were having that conversation, I had just decided, I had taken a week of just painting. And one of the things that came out of it, I had started painting with a model head. And then it morphed into something else as I was painting. And then I was like, this idea of the head as a still life, I had just kind of stacked all these objects together, and it had kind of come organically. And then we had our conversation. So it was very timely. So the idea of portraiture is, one, very challenging, and sometimes it's not been in vogue, really. And then, like, the 19th century, the headless portraiture and photography was really this huge thing that's, like, they were just going wild with it. So the symbolism of the head as powerful or as part of warfare, it's a range. Anyone else who is in the show, we see have a few people here that would like to start talking about their work and what inspired them, please.
My name is Jeff Stein. I'm a recovering lawyer. For me, the head, it can become almost abstract when it's blown up. I am interested in the shift between, you can see the collage in the text up close, and then in the distance, it comes together into tones and a form. I used to, when I was painting and not collaging, I would always have a self-portrait going to have something to work on. And I like to say that the model was there and mildly cooperative, you know, because models space and they don't show up and, you know, all these other things. So I'm definitely very interested in the notion of self-portrait and the portrait as an object and the painting as an object. So.
And using the collage method to do that is even more challenging. Like, how did that come about for you as far as deciding and the method that, how did you weave into that? Like, from, were you in oil before and then?
Yeah, no, I spent 10 years drawing and studying anatomy and failing to combine art and law. Then I was at the studio school for 4 years and I got an MFA from the Slade. I had occasionally worked in collage as part of something. It was a way to fill space in the rectangle. I also liked the idea at the studio school for the last couple of years. I was a real scavenger and none of my drawings were squared because I was using found material. I was using leftover drawings people had left or newspapers or leaflets and stuff. And so I was, you know, beginning to use stuff from my experience, from my life. The notion of using things from the people's world came about in 08, 09 during the credit crunch when I was, or the Great Recession, whatever you want to call it, when I was trying to understand what was going on. And I began doing portraits of some of the actors in that. I began with Alan Greenspan. And, you know, I was thinking about in Renaissance portraiture, there's always a symbol in the background that's an attribute of the person being painted. And so how do you take those symbols or those things from that person's life and make the portrait out of that? And that that grew into this practice that I've been pursuing. And not to be overtly political with this group, but, you know, with Trump, it just, I couldn't do anything else, really. I needed to respond to that. So. That's what I did. I don't know. I don't know how you think about collage, Stephanie. I mean, it also gives you something from your time, you know, and so during the pandemic, the beginning of the pandemic, the raging COVID, I was using pieces of the newspaper, you know, I was using COVID maps and headlines and different things. And that was maybe the only record of that, because otherwise more and more people are reading the news online or listening to the news online or looking at the memes online instead of reading the news. So there's a historical aspect that I find interesting. It's of our time.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's very compelling. It's such a great use of the materials. And Stefania, did you have or have you been incorporating symbolism into your portraiture that you've been doing? Or would you describe the symbolism that you have been using?
Yeah, I guess there is symbolism. I guess almost everything has symbolism in a way. It's just... I guess intent, I don't think there's much in, well, I guess now I'm thinking of different pieces. The one that I think I'm actually going to put on the show, which is a portrait with a necklace, I guess the necklace has some symbolism attached to it. So Yes, is the answer. I find some of them weird tricky because I enjoy it a lot, but I have, I guess, through the past 2 years of being scrutinized under an MFA lens, symbolism becomes very dangerous because people attach a lot of significance to things that you might have just included because they felt right or looked right, or it was an association you had with. You know, I work a lot by association. I think of something and I think of something else and I kind of let it free flow. But then you get scrutinized by, oh, so you meant to say this. And I was like, no, I really didn't. I should think about that more. It's like, oops, when you're, you know, mistakenly conveying messages that you did not intend, it becomes a little dangerous learning about that.
Yeah. But then also, like, just because they might have misinterpreted it, should you be changing your choices?
No. I mean, yeah. The short answer, I think, is no. But you should be aware of the possible, like, if someone's reading something into it that never occurred to you, perhaps it's worth considering that possibility and deciding if you want to go that route. I don't think you should ever change the message you're trying to convey for anyone, but you don't want to put the wrong message out that you don't agree with, if that's the consensus. If you were just ignorant, maybe that happens. It's like, oops.
The gentle critique as search and destroy mission. I think, you know, you're working very intuitively, Steph, and I think that's totally acceptable, if not preferable. And for me, I paint because I don't have words for it and let them sort it out later. And I love when someone has a totally different view, and because the context has changed. And the, you know, years ago, I had a painting of a model with a scarf over her head, lying back and resting. She was sleeping. She was tired. And it was just when the Iraq war started. And the painting was in the window at the studio school for a while. And I was wondering how long it would take before someone says, you can't show a hostage. And it didn't take very long. But that wasn't the intention. But the context, the world changed in those weeks between the painting being done and the war starting. So anyway.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of something that was, yeah, completely not intended and having a powerful meaning. But yeah, you could embrace that meaning or not, I guess. Yeah.
No, I hate postmodernism, but, you know, it's very postmodern. It's what the viewer thinks it means, you know, unfortunately or fortunately. So I don't know. So is the Academy very focused on intentionality and intention?
It varies per teacher, instructor, how much they care about that. Some of them are very much about you having a statement behind your work. Others are just like, the work should speak for itself, and if it doesn't, you've not done a good job. So it really varies. I just feel like I had never before put my work in the context of art history. I'd always just viewed my work as my work, and so that's something I've learned a lot, is when you put something in your painting, it will reflect all the prior use of that same messaging. So I've just become more
It's interesting.
Attuned to that. Yeah.
For your piece with your head on the platter, which pieces, or were there pieces that you had seen from art history that spoke to you, that brought you to that composition?
Yeah, I've been wanting to do a Salome with the Head of John Baptist version for a long time, and I'd been playing around with different compositions. The farthest I got before I put my own head on the platter was a circle of women holding, like, in a sort of kind of like Eyes Wide Shut type of setting, and then with a head in the middle, but I couldn't decide if it was a mask or a men's head, and it was like way too complicated. The messaging was too complicated, and so it was like a long, like 3 or 4 years of thinking, and then suddenly I realized, well, what better head to put on the platter than my own? So, yeah. and then you have the question of, well, does the you that's holding the head have a head, or is that the head from that body, and that's why I cropped it to not identify if it's the same person, or, you know, open to interpretation. But I wanted the portrait to at least resemble me so that I'm not putting someone else's head on a platter.
And did you say that the piece that you're probably going to put in this show has a necklace that was symbolic?
Yeah, so it's a different piece. I'm still working on it, but I'm happy to share if it'll help the discussion. This will be a self-portrait, and I will be wearing a pearl necklace, which I find hilarious, personally. And I did on purpose mimic the girl with the pearl earring. It really intentionally, like, overlaid. It's like a perfect match. Obviously, the face is different, but just a sort of a joke. And I've been following all the news with, like, the Vermeer exhibit at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. They moved all the Vermeers there, and then at the Maurits house, where all the Vermeers actually reside permanently, they've put in a bunch of artist interpretations of the girl with the pearl earring, including an AI art, or someone that prompted an AI to make, a bot to make such a piece. So I just kind of got on board with that, just out of spite in a way. And I thought, why not a necklace? Because that's hilarious for those that understand it. Yeah, so I'm still working on it. It's going to take a while. And hopefully I'll have it done by the show so I can put this one in.
Yeah, what's the size for that?
It's about, it's like 13 by 14 by 20, 13 by 19, something like that. Yeah.
What's it on?
It's aluminum, so I only paint on aluminum pretty much.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's nice and slippery and shiny. So next up is sanding this down so that the aluminum shows through, and then starting again. And I sort of paint over the same thing over and over and over and over. It's like trial and error.
How many layers is this at this point?
On the face, probably 3 or 4. Like, you can see some of the gridding in the back, which I've started using. Because people, I had instructors push me to project. And I am just philosophically against that. And I am very judgmental of people who do that, even though I think everyone except for 2 people in my school do that. Like, it's very market acceptable. I'm just personally judgmental of it. So gridding was the sort of next attempt to follow instructions. And I actually really like it. I think gridding is, I've enjoyed it. So,
had you done that before you went to the academy?
No. I've always been a very disorganized sort of throw paint of things and see where it lands. Still figurative, but, you know, very like observational purely. So I'm becoming a little more organized, which is helpful because it avoids distortion. But you also miss out on, you know, if I was doing this without a grid, perhaps the mouth would have ended up way larger, and the eyes and whatever I'm focusing on would have been expanded, and everything else would have shrunk, which looks worse, but is interesting, you know? So you kind of lose that playfulness. I'm curious how other people approach that sort of, how other people tackle that sort of challenge.
Next, Nagel Institute Research Associate and artist Nabundo Obi shares about a few of the works she's considering to include in this show.
I took the prompt quite literally when I picked out some of these pieces. So this is a portrait that I did of my mom when she turned 50 during the beginning of the pandemic. And I decided that I was going to learn how to, I guess, do a more traditional looking portrait. So using brush. So because typically I like to use a palette knife, that's what I enjoy using. But I decided I was going to learn how to use a brush, which was a very interesting experience. There are times where I got really frustrated because I was thinking about all the paint that was going to waste. And I was going, why? This one is a self-portrait that I did. I think it was my freshman year in college. And it's all palette knife. And it's called, I believe I have it written down somewhere here. It's called Seeing Through My Third Eye. And it was a final project. And I'll give you the dimensions. It is 23 inches and 3/4 by 30 inches. So it's fairly big. And I was inspired to paint it during a time that was pretty, I would say, emotionally turbulent for me. I think that year, somebody in my year was murdered at a party. That, in conjunction with a bunch of things that were happening in my personal life, I was feeling very confused and very lost. And so I channeled that into this self-portrait.
And palette knife is so challenging.
Yes, but I love it.
It's so great. Yeah, I love it too.
I love it because you can get all these like textures and movements, and it's just very tactile in a way that painting with a brush isn't. Because you can also use like different things for your mark making. You're using palette knives. You can like use a pen. You can use like different objects to get different textures, which is what I really, really enjoy about palette knife. But I haven't done that in a while. I decided that I wanted to kind of explore painting with a brush. This is another portrait I did. It's of my dad. It's not finished. It's almost done. It's supposed to be a birthday gift, but I never finished it because my model wouldn't sit still. He refused, actually, to sit. So it's unfinished. So I think I'm going to have to take some creative liberties and just so I can complete the piece. But I was more so kind of going off of what Steph was talking about. I was more so trying to learn how to use gridding because I found that sometimes when I draw, my proportions are off. And then for some reason, it kind of annoys me when I know that I'm trying to draw a person. If it's from my imagination, then I don't really care about proportions or anything. It doesn't matter to me. It's more so about conveying the concept or the idea than to get it like technically like accurate. So yeah, so that's what I did with this portrait. I basically broke everything up into boxes and squares, and I drew my dad, and I started painting. I was also kind of trying to learn how to paint brown and black skin tones, which is still something that I'm learning. But I actually like how this turned out. I initially was sort of bothered by the beige like shadow on his forehead, but now I'm like, I think it works. I think it corresponds with the pictures I took. And that's something that I'm learning to accept, is that sometimes when you're using a reference picture and you have a real model, you don't necessarily have to capture what you see. You can actually play around with colors and textures and shapes.
I love the way you've sort of broken down the planes of the face in different colors, and also kind of turn them into graphic shapes, but they all, it reads really well in a, you know, like if you squint down, it's like a perfect portrait. And then if you want to, you can focus on the different shapes and the different colors. So there's that option to go in and out. And I think that's really cool.
Oh, thank you.
That's what I was thinking, but she said it very well for me.
Yeah.
Hooray, and then all that money I'm spending on the NFT.
And so was it oil or what are you using for both your mother and father's?
Yes, it's oil. It's all oil. I that's what I prefer. I don't yet have the speed for acrylic. Acrylic paints can be very unforgiving. And so I opt for oil because I can always move things around and blend things out.
So I have this teacher that paints with acrylic, but he uses it as oil paint. So he uses this slow dry medium. Mixes it with the acrylic so that it's not as fast drying as usual, but it's also not as slow as oil paint because he wants to make like thousands of layers. Like according to him, he literally has thousands of layers. And you can actually see if you get close, like how it's all stacked up. And so he slows down the acrylic to get an in-between. You might be interested in that.
Yeah. Thanks for telling me about that. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. I don't know how many people do that, but he's very into that. And he's
which medium does he use?
On he does paper or primed canvas, and then it's like I don't remember the brand, but it's called slow dry medium for acrylic. But he's pretty open about his process. His name is Peter Drake, and he's pretty accomplished, and it really creates this neat sort of layering that you can get with oil paint. It just takes way longer with oil paint.
Yeah.
Because if you go in too soon and it's still wet, it's going.
I know. Yeah. This one is a self-portrait, but it's more on the, I was more so going for like a sci-fi dystopian look. So hence why everything is kind of gray and dull and dark. I drew inspiration from what was happening around that time period, so like 2017. So I was hearing a lot about global warming and the ocean, like the disruption of ecosystems in the ocean and things like that. And then at the same time, I was also taking a lot of classes on a lot of sociology classes about juvenile delinquency and prisons and related topics. And then in my personal life, I was sort of going through like a transition. So a friendship that I had for most of, I would say, my childhood kind of fell apart. So I was very much feeling, I guess, kind of alien, like I was in a different space and I wasn't really sure if I was going to be able to like get through it emotionally. And that's why I'm wearing like a fishbowl or an astronaut's helmet on my head, and there's water kind of under my nose, because I guess at that time I kind of felt like I was drowning, well, almost drowning, poured all of that into this print. It's a copper etching. I used to do a lot of printmaking back in the day. It has a companion, a different, I'm going to get it framed and I'll probably show it at a different time.
Can you describe that one for us?
It looks like this one, but there are a few elements that are different. So the figure is still the same. It's just that there are other elements around it. Yeah, and it's a different color. It's a blue color.
And we close with Jeff Stein sharing about his collage portrait of Liz Cheney.
So, So this is 30 by 30. It's done with collage, paper collage, and I call it glazing with acrylic paint, thinned down. So in person, you can see the text everywhere. The cameras cameras are dumb. Your eyes much smarter. So you can, the camera shows things that are opaque color or opaque tone, whereas your eye would be able to see the original text in there. So what I do is it's very close to kind of classical drawing almost. I start with the darks. I figure out where they are. I put them in. Then I move on to the next tone and the next and the next. And what will happen is I'll try to, using Photoshop and also working on the Xerox machine, when I Xerox these, the paper, I blow the text up or down. I make it lighter or darker. So I'm trying to develop a palette of grays in the collage. And so I work it. One of the final things was I ended up putting a cool, very, very light, cool gray on the background to pop the figure forward, which is something I often do. So, yeah.
What's the time frame usually when you're doing this for?
Dear God.
Yeah, it's always a...
I used to always say they take me a month, whether it's, you know, 4 by 5 inches or 6 feet. I've settled on the 30 by 30 size for these because it gives you enough real estate to have something going on, but it's small enough that you can make changes without it taking months. This took about a month. They have been running from 1 to 4 months during the pandemic. But I think I'm back towards about a month for them. That's not working every day. That's, you know, 4 days a week, say. And, you know, it's not an 8-hour day. It's squeezing time in and, you know, there's a lot going on in everyone's lives and that kind of stuff.
Did you have mistakes that you ran into or when you're doing revisions, like, are there any spots?
Oh, yes. If you go to my site, I believe there is a GIF, a stop action video of this being made. And you'll see stuff going in and out. The mouth gets worked on for, I don't know, 10 days or something. Just small, small changes, but it's, you know, it's working, it's not working. I have on my site, there's one of Vice President Harris, and you can see the background changing from, because it was, instead of being red, white, and blue, it ended up reading as the French flag, red, white, and blue, in the wrong order. So I had to redo it. The one of Joe Biden, I ended up endlessly chasing the profile and other things, the mouth and the chin and stuff. So that was 3 months. And at some point, one loses one's will to go on. So you're making less and less changes, and it's taking more and more time. So
was it Michelangelo that said, I don't remember if it was him, that no painting is ever finished, it's just abandoned. So.
Totally.
Some great artist said that.
No, sounds like Michelangelo or Rembrandt. Maybe.
So do you ever draw before? I know you've described it before.
Yeah, no, I do a drawing and then I project it. Usually I I have done them with, you know, so for the first 7 years I painted, I only worked from life. And then when I got out of school, models are expensive. They don't show up. I began trying to integrate photos into my practice. I think it's really hard to work from photos. Yeah. I so prefer working from life, but Representative Cheney failed to show up on time. So I was forced to use photos of her. And, you know, so what I'm interested in is the collage. So for me, blowing it up using a projector is fine, even though I totally feel like it's cheating from the studio school where everything was from life.
Oh, really? Because my school people are just fine with that. But
wow.
Well, I was going to say the dirty little secret is that basically everyone except for Joe Santori and maybe you, Steph, works from photographs. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I have to as well. Sometimes, you know.
I just had to start. I was having trouble with models, and I began being interested in the credit crunch stuff. So I went to working from photos.
It's very hard because so much information is lost to the photograph, like you just explained, where the translucency of things and the color and all the darks get really dark, and it's just. You have to sort of learn to read the photograph, I guess.
Absolutely. And there's also, there is lens distortion in the photographs that you, having studied anatomy at the academy, will recognize in some of the head, on some of the photos of people. You can see distortions in rounding and in, you know, and also in the photograph, the camera combining things that your eye is distinguishing. I mean, basically this is broken down into, I believe, 7 different tones in a background. So one of the things I'm doing also is I am trying to use the direction of the type as a tool to define planes. And yeah, somewhere in between defining planes and defining tone. There are certain instances in which I'll line something up throughout the portrait, like a screen would line up on a print or something. And I like the ability to move back and forth between a graphic and a more three-dimensional looking, the flatness and the dimensionality. I like going back and forth on that.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. It looks so impossible to me. I'm just like, if you just drew this, it would be so much.
No.
It's wonderful how much thought goes into every placement.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me a lot of printmaking and graphic design. I mean, when you just said that you are very like specific, that you use the text and the colors to accentuate the different planes of the face and the texture and the hair. I really, really like, my favorite part of this piece is the hair. I really like it. Especially the little like wisps of hair going down. Yes, I'm really into like little details like that. It's like very clean, very crisp. Yeah.
Well, I love graphic design. I mean, I love Milton Glaser's work, and you know all the other people. I played around with the notion of being an art director, but never did it. I was working in a law firm, and it wasn't really didn't make any sense anymore. But I love the idea of the graphic versus the pictorial. And I love graphic design. I also like that something flips back and forth in terms of the plasticity versus the graphic flatness. And to me, that becomes interesting. So.
And I have to confess that over the years, whenever I hear the word collage, I inwardly go, oh no, how do you do that? Because I have tried collaging before, and I don't know, I felt almost a bit like an imposter. Almost like, what are you doing? You don't know what you're doing with these pieces of paper and random things. But after seeing your work, I'm like, okay, this is how it can look. This is one out of many possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, my notion of playing with text, grew out of a failed attempt in a graphic arts class I took while I was a lawyer, 2D design class, to trying to do a tonal scale using only text from the Wall Street Journal, and it didn't work, but it was interesting to me, and I stored it away in the back of my little pea brain for future use. And I guess I think of paint, pieces of paint, as light and space. And I think of the collage as pieces of paint, really, that you play with. And you can go back and forth. That's the other thing. You can correct. Because I'm using acrylic, I can put something over. I can paint over it. I can cut it out. I like to sand them as a way of blending and cutting through to the underlying material sometimes.
Yeah. Does the sanding ever go deadly wrong?
Everything always goes deadly wrong, all the time. Welcome to my world. I think it's kind of a notion from the studio school that, drawing or painting is so much about correction. It's about, as you see better, you correct more. And, it's... everything. I'll be refining the profile till the end. Often I will end up putting in, details at the end. The badge was one of the last things, and that's put in over the more opaque dark of the lapel. And and I mean, the other thing is, this is Xerox paper, so it's it's toner on paper. And one of the things you can do is you can wet the paper, and then using a brush or a paper towel, you can wipe off some of the pigment, and so you can lighten it in areas. I'm working on a portrait of Obama, and the eyebrow was too dark, so I ended up sanding it, and that worked for me at that point.
And I may have missed this. I apologize if I did. So around the edge of the face, is that a wash that you did also?
Do you mean the dark on the left-hand side?
Yeah.
So that is collage material, and that is a dark printed, playing with the exposure on the Photoshop. I grabbed a headline from the Times, and then I photoshopped it. And then when I printed it, I printed it. I used a function that made it multiple times,
printed it out, and then actually did a physical paste-up of it so that there wouldn't be any lines between the things, and then I printed it on the Xerox machine. You know, once again, this was the front page from the local paper, Voters Reject Cheney. There's a picture of her, and I did a photograph in Photoshop. I played with it, I sized it, and then I used the exposure function on Photoshop to get it to the size I wanted.
If you also are an artist who works in or studies the law and would like to participate in this show or find out more details, please message me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com. Until next time, this is Stephanie Drotty bringing you Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What are your plans for the second Saturday of this month? Perhaps consider joining in for a discussion about art, culture, and social issues. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and every second Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I host the Second Saturday Art and Justice Gathering, an online call that explores a range of topics, from artists who might inspire to legal decisions that might infuriate, all with the aim of sparking dialogue about social justice and promoting creative thinking. If interested, please email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com.